No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the discussion by calling in at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype your questions to BBSRADIOPR. We gave Maria the day off today because she's a mom. So let me start by saying Happy Mother's Day, Maria, and then let me move on to wishing my wife, Patty, who raised three perfect children, not to mention me and the dog, wish her a happy Mother's Day and say that, you know, I was blessed. I only had my mother for 15 years. She's been gone for almost 50 years now, but I think about her every day. So I want to start the show there, and I'm very lucky today to have my good friend, occasional co-host and just wonderful man about town, Doug, with us. Doug, are you there?
I am here. Hi, yeah. Everyone.
And what a voice. I mean, you know, has anybody told you you had the voice for radio, or you just got lucky?
Would you believe I hear that daily?
Yeah, I would believe it, because you got a great voice. And I once said, somebody said that to me one time, and I once said it to a radio guy. I said, I have the voice for, somebody told me I had the voice for radio, and he looked at me and said, I don't know if you got the voice for radio, but you sure got the face for radio.
You got the looks for it.
Yeah, guys, I got the looks, and that's a horrible thing to say. It stunted my growth, I think, as a radio personality. But nonetheless, I persevered. So we're here today, and can we start the discussion by talking about Mother's Day? It was started by a woman named Anna Jarvis, and this year is the 110th anniversary. The celebration started, the first celebration was in an Episcopal church in Grafton, West Virginia. And, as it turns out, it became a national holiday in 1914, when President Woodrow Wilson signed a bill recognizing Jarvis's Mother's Day as a national holiday. So we've been celebrating it now for a very long time, well over 100 years. And, you know, I what would we do without our mothers?
Oh, gosh. Everything that I could attribute that's good within me could be attributed to my mother.
Yeah, me too. Me too. And you know what? And I had several mothers, because my mother passed away when I was 15. And I can't tell you the other women in my life who stepped in, who saw a boy out there without, you know, I didn't have any money. My family was pretty much destroyed. My father was already gone at that point. And you know, I can't tell you the women that I've had in my life when I was young that mothered me. And I had a neighbor named Lucille who was like a mom to me until she died. When she was, this was about 10 or 15 years ago, she passed away. My children treated her like a grandmother. I've had a lot of like wonderful women in my life. So for all the moms out there, God bless each and every one of you. And let me say this, officially, if DC becomes a state and I ever get a vote, my first piece of legislation is going to be to amend President Wilson's proclamation and have Mother Week. We shouldn't have a day for these people. We should have a week.
That's great.
They're so important, right?
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
probably the most important thing I can envision, you know.
Yeah. They're just, you know, what
Dads
we
get busy.
I lie about it all the time on the campaign trail. You know, I stand out there and say, I raised three children. The truth, not that I want to spread this around, but the truth of the matter is Pat Brown raised three perfect children, and I just stayed the hell out of the way. You know, I paid for to help raise them, but beyond that, she really did all the heavy lifting.
Oh, well, I have a twin brother, you know, four children, teenagers. And,
oh, my God.
His wife, Melissa, that handles them all. And it was tough for me being around children, being that I'm not married and I have no children. But, you know, I respected how she, I'm telling you, they dote on every child, and it takes so much energy. All right, we actually have Deborah on line one.
Okay, Deborah, how are you?
Thanks for calling in. I'm fine. I wanted to wish Mrs. Brown, because I know she's listening. You said she listens to every show. I just wanted to wish her a very happy Mother's Day. Uh-huh. I wanted to say a happy Mother's Day to our old co-host, Kathleen Gomez, and to our current co-host, Maria Sanchez, who's at home with her kids, and to Melissa Newsom as well. So happy Mother's Day.
Well, thanks, Deborah. Thanks for calling in. And that's really a faux pas on my part, because I should have mentioned our old co-host, Kathleen Gomez, not only the mother of two wonderful sons, but the oldest one is my godson. So I hope Diego and Mateo are out there spoiling their mom today, because that's what they should be doing. So thanks for calling in and pointing that out.
You're welcome. Have a great show.
All right. Thanks. So, you know, you said let's get busy, Doug. So let's talk. You know, I went to the most beautiful little town, a place called Cascais, Portugal, to attend a international conference for an organization called Horasys. And Horasys is a global organization that brings together leaders from all over the world and hooks them up with political people as well. And they do seminars for 5 days. They have an interaction and a meeting, and I met people from 70 countries. It was the most amazing thing. And before I go any farther, let me also say that I forgot to mention the woman who really raised me, and that's my sister, Patricia. Sometimes I forget, because Pat passed away, unfortunately, about 20 years ago. And, you know, but she raised me. And one of the most wonderful things about going back to Cascais and being in this hotel and going to this forum was that we had a dinner one night, a big dinner at the casino there. And my sister took me to that casino to have dinner. It's very famous. It was the inspiration for Casino Royale, the James Bond book. And she took me there when I was 16 years old, and that was the last time that I had been there. So it was really amazing to go in, and it hasn't changed much, to go in and see it, and it was great. So Patricia, wherever you are in the universe, I love you, and I think about you every day. The get together was just amazing. It was amazing. People from all over the world, and I got to talk about the American dream.
Mm. Wow!
So that was really great for me.
I bet.
Got great reviews. I was on the. It was me a international journalist named Wendy Dent, and from Guardian News Network, and it was a senator from Maryland named Stephen Waugh, and we sat and we talked about the American dream and what it meant to us. And I think the only disappointment of the people in the crowd is that we didn't fight with each other. I think they wanted us to fight because I was a Democrat and he was a Republican. Really? And I said, yeah. And at one point in the middle of the thing, I apologized. I said, you know, I really want to say horrible things about this man, but unfortunately I like him, so I can't do that. And we're both proud to be Americans, right? Sure. That's that right. So we really didn't have any nasty things to say to each other, and that really is the basis of the show, this show, Shadow Politics, is try to bring people together.
Isn't it amazing how you had to go to a foreign country to feel national pride and be able to exhibit it? Can you get away with that here? Can you get away with that here, the pride of America, and still not be considered somehow, you know, a little bit more right-wing than left? I don't know. I just kind of sense that idea is.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I think the other problem here is that you've got to buy into everything. You know, I can't love America and be a Republican if I'm a Democrat or vice versa.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, you got to buy into the whole thing. And I think that's something that Marie and I talk about all the time is that. You know, we disagree on things, but we both have great respect for each other. And that's where I started my discussion with this man from Maryland. I found things about him that I could respect. And he's a former Marine. He was an officer in the Marine Corps, graduated from the Naval Academy. And I have great respect for that. I have great respect for anybody that stood up on my behalf to protect my country. And my brother Paul was an instructor at the Air Force Academy, so I understand what special people there are that go to those academies, the Naval Air Force Academy. So that's where I start. I start with from a place of respect, and it's also the place that I always start with Maria because we all have great respect for her, huh?
Sure. You know, Maria, what a lady. Intelligent. You're going for a doctorate, having children.
Yes.
I just am so amazed. Even the way she articulates her sentences, the thought she puts into her questions, you know, she's very, very intelligent. And
And what a great person. You know, she helped dig wells for women that didn't have water. Mm. She helped. She went to the third world. Right. And if that's not cool enough, she also drove a Harley. She's got it all going on.
Yes. Yes, indeed. With the adventurous side.
Yes, absolutely.
Wow.
So, you know, that's the thing. We really got to bring people together. And I can't tell you.
Well, you know how you do it. I had a brain. I always call it a brain fart, but I have a lot of them. And yesterday I was thinking, you know. And I laughed, I chuckled. I said, I really should be, you know, sitting with the CIA as part of a think tank just because my ideas, they come to me. But one of the things I was thinking, what would happen? You know how we look at each other and we come at common ground. We see common perspective. That's how we initially bond. Well, imagine a movie, if you will, and you have three situations. One where the guy believes in, let's say, communism, and then another scene where part of the movie, a guy believes in guns, right? Another part of the movie, the guy is a Democrat. And then through that, the second half of the movie, an act of God, rubbing a genie, who cares? They're immediately put into the opposite of perspective of what they thought was the evil part, right? They're the Republican. Now they hate guns. And you could do this with everything that goes up and down, everything that has, you know, a positive spin where one person believes this and doesn't believe that. And they change their opinions utterly due to the circumstances of their life. Like you and I could argue about the merits of capitalism, communism, so forth, but we'd also have to take in an understanding of the society, the culture of the time, and why maybe more of a socialistic, or maybe even a not a, so much a communistic, but a feudalistic society would be more beneficial than, let's say, a capitalistic one, in given that they might have large families, they have lots of land, and there's very few of them, and you know that's how they make their living, right? Mm-hmm. But just imagine going to that opposite side and figuring out the opposite point of view. So it hits you every time. The movie basically is a catalyst to make you live on both sides of the thought spectrum. And each one, at the very end of it, come out believing that is exactly true and hating the other side. And then the opposite happens to you, right?
Right.
So you're just showing the world that based on perspectives, really, there are lots of opinions. And those opinions can be valid. You know, there isn't a right or wrong so much. I think that's one of the wonderful things about law. You know, it's always growing, and it tries to account for these things. That's why it is always growing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I assume that if Steven Spielberg is out there listening, which he probably does, he should glam onto this idea. We have this happen all the time, and it's funny that you should bring it up in the context of a movie, for example, because how many times do those things change our lives, right? How can you watch? One of the things I watched on the way over on the plane, because my wife uploaded a few movies for me so that I could watch them on the plane on my little iPad. And one of the things that I watched was Schindler's List. Now, how could you watch a movie like Schindler's List and not be moved?
Right.
Right. You couldn't possibly know the horror of the Holocaust without living through it. Mm. But, certainly, that movie has to, if you have a soul, that movie touches you. Absolutely. To imagine what it must have been like and to put yourself in that position,
right,
for a little while. If for nothing else, to say how lucky you are to live in a world that we live in today, because of the brave men and women that went over to fight fascism. And it also teaches you important lessons, right? Because Germany, just while I'm on the subject, I don't want to digress too much, but Germany was a great democracy for a very long time when fascism came to rise. So we should never assume that it can't happen again. So,
well, maybe it comes to rise because we get to a point, this is just hypothetical probably, but we have too much choice. One would understand freedom as a basis of choice, right? If I have a choice, I have freedom to make the decision, right? Well, if I took you into a department store that's 50,000 square feet and all it's got is different types of toothpaste, when the choice becomes now almost a problem, right? Mm-hmm. So in my way, I think that the opportunity to have infinite choice is a good thing, but I don't think we really want that. And maybe that's the tug of allowing other things the ability to assume that responsibility for us, right?
Mm-hmm.
And take care of us that way. Hmm?
The only thing that I would say to that is that I think the bigger problem is that we accept the choice. We have we accept that we have the freedom to make the choices, but we don't accept the responsibility that goes with the choices. And very often, we see that. We see that, if you take another issue, like let's take gun control, that the Second Amendment gives you a right to have a gun. But where's the responsibility that's connected to that right? Mm-hmm. A lot of people end it there. Mm-hmm. They say, well, I have a right to have a gun. Well, yeah, what if the gun falls in the wrong hands? What if you don't use the gun properly? Mm-hmm. What if, there needs to be a responsibility connected to those choices. And I really don't think that very often we think about the responsibilities. We only think about the freedom.
Right. Right. You know? I totally agree with you. Well, that takes a real, looking deep inside towards future consequences. yes. and seeing them. And most people don't want to expend that energy there.
Yes. Or
figure out a cost to that.
And I got to tell you, it also requires having a good mother.
Right.
You know, let's bring it full circle. It has to teach in our children that there's responsibility.
Right.
And it bothers me, and I don't know about you, but I'm considerably older, but it bothers me to see that we've lost this sense of responsibility, especially community responsibility.
Right.
You know, that we live together in a social society. I can tell you that when I was a kid, we had one car in a house of like 10 people. So my grandmother and I took the bus everywhere we went. And one of my earliest childhood memories is being 4 or 5 years old and being on a bus with my grandmother. And there'd be some young woman standing up in her 20s or 30s. And my grandmother would make me go offer my seat.
Right.
Right. Now I would always tug on some girl's skirt and say, would you like my seat? And they would always, almost without exception, look down at me and say, that's very nice, honey, because I was so small.
Right.
But that's okay.
Right.
And then I would have to look back at them and say, you don't understand. I'm here with that crazy Italian woman, and I cannot go back. That's not an option for me. If I go back and say to my grandmother, she doesn't want the seat, my grandmother just pushed me out in the aisle and say, go convince her. Yeah. So your choices here, young lady, you can feel awkward while this little boy stands there and stares at you, or you can go take the seat next to the crazy Italian lady.
Isn't that great, though?
And yes, it is. Until this day, it bothers me. I never get on a crowded metro or a crowded, you know, at the airport, they have these things called people movers. I don't know if you've ever been to Dulles, but it's a very small airport. They designed it so that everything would be close. So what happens is they put you on these big things that are like buses, and they take you out to the plane. So it has a big runway and everything, but the terminal itself is not that large. So, you know, it bothers me to be on that thing and see men sitting down, able-bodied men in their 20s, while women in heels are sitting up. In fact, we came back from Hawaii when my kids were little, and there was a pregnant woman standing, and there were 20 men sitting down. And she was obviously pregnant, 8 or 9 months, and nobody was going to offer a seat until I said to my 8-year-old, get up and go give that woman your seat. And when he did, some of the men were embarrassed, and they offered, you know, and they did the same. But, you know, the little things, it's those little things, holding a door for somebody, you know.
Pulling out a chair.
Yeah, pulling out a chair. And I won't be a hypocrite.
Shoveling a neighbor's driveway out of snow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And it doesn't come. It's got nothing to do with money. It's got nothing to do with power. It's got to do with who you are as a person.
Right.
You know, we had a woman across the street from us down a big steep hill, and ambulances couldn't. Her husband had a heart attack, and the ambulances couldn't get to her because there was so much snow. We just had a snowstorm, and there was like 2.5 feet of snow, and they couldn't get the ambulance down the street. Some volunteer fireman who was in a local, making extra money at the local shopping center with his pickup truck with a snowplow on the front, heard a call on his radio, plowed out the street so the ambulance could get there, realized that the woman was elderly, got out of his truck and shoveled out her driveway and her walk so that she could get to the hospital and visit her husband. And of course the man survived, and the wife was able to visit him. And you know, that's the kind of thing we need to do for each other.
I don't know if society allows us, like, you know, we can't give out free food. We can't make lemonade in the corner any longer. There's so many things that people that want to come and do good can't so much anymore. I don't know why that's the case. Well, that's always puzzled me. Another thing that's always puzzled me, maybe there's a reason. Maybe I haven't thought about it. Maybe because due to animals or insects. But why, when they plant a tree, why don't we just plant trees in the middle of the roads or wherever we have to plant them that actually bear fruit? I don't understand that. I mean, if you're going to, it's the same. It's not going to take more water, really more care. Perhaps it would, but the neighborhood would love that. So everywhere you're just planting things that actually produce something. You know, it's a different sort. That shares with the culture. Look, we are looking to utilize things that produce, that give us something back. You know, it might even create a cultural shift. You know, these little things, even though they're ideas, they're smart ideas. And I wonder why we don't employ them and we do the opposite. It puzzles me.
Well, you know what? I think that that's one of the problems that's led to the divisiveness that's going on in America right now is exactly what you just said. I mean, I hear this from people all the time that things are overregulated and they're tired of political correctness carried to the ridiculous extreme, and they're, you know, that they want to. I think this is one of the sentiments that Trump, President Trump, plugged into. You know, make America great again. And it bothers me because I've seen America as always being great, but I think that resonated with people. Yeah, you know what? I got no problem with them putting up a menorah in my elementary school, but why can't I have a Christian at Christmas time, right?
Right.
I mean,
well, they hit us all with a lot. It's funny because a lot, too much maybe came too fast. Yeah. You know, that's a whole other thing. If you're going to confuse the mind, hit them with 8 different problems, not 7, because they might be able to do this. It's like a phone number. They might know 7, they can deal with it. But give them 8 problems, then give them 9, then give them 10. And that's what seems to be occurring, and people just get blown away by that, and they tend to stop thinking about it. If you give somebody an overwhelming number of issues all the time to deal with, and that's what seems to be also a problem. There always seems to be fires to put out, bad people here, And the people are becoming polarized due to that. It's really strange. Yeah. We don't, you know, it's no longer we. It's I love this. I tell people this. I.
Right.
No, we, us. But we don't use that, you know. We just don't.
Right. You know what? I'm out getting people to nominate me to run for public office. And so the way we do that in the District of Columbia is you get signatures on a ballot petition, and they have to be of your party, and you got to get enough to get nominated. So you go to public places where you would find people that you believe are Democrats and are Washingtonians, right? So one of the places you go is metro stops because they're easy. People go to work in the morning and they come home at night. And it's pretty much especially if you go out at night and somebody's taking a metro stop into a neighborhood, it's a pretty good idea they live there. But I can't tell you how many people don't talk to each other. Mm-hmm. They're all plugged into their little iPhones, iPads, I this and I that, listening to their own music. And you want to say to them, I got to a point where I wanted to scream at them, don't spend enough time alone that when you're in public, you can't interact with people?
Right.
I mean, isn't that the experience of being in public? Want to interact? I mean, I do when I'm out there. You know, I want to talk to people. And you know what I find out? This embarrasses the hell out of my children. I talk to people all the time. If I see you standing on a corner and you got on an Ohio State t-shirt, I say, oh, where are you from in Ohio? And they say, you know, Cleveland, whatever. And I say, oh, I have a brother in Zanesville. And they go, oh, I know Zanesville. And, you know, and you strike up a conversation. Sure. My kids hate that. But
really? Yeah. It embarrasses them, does it?
Yeah, it embarrasses them. Their attitude. Well, you say that Don has teenagers, so you know how it works, right?
I do.
Shut up, pay the bill, shut up, and drive me where I want to go. you know, but for God's sake, don't talk. And worse yet, don't get any attention to yourself. Oh, my God.
You know? Oh, my gosh. Yes.
So, you know, and that, this is one thing about I love about New Yorkers. Let me tell you a quick story. We go to New York with our kids, and again, happy Mother's Day, Kathleen Gomez, because what Kathleen used to do is she lived in New York, and she would go away for a couple weeks in the summer and make her apartment available to us. So we would go, we'd take the kids up there for, you know, long weekends and stuff. So this is so much different than people are in most places in the country. But I'm standing on a street corner with my daughters, with all three of my kids and my wife, and a handsome cab goes by, you know, a horse-drawn carriage. And my daughter says to me, she's about, I don't know, 7 or 8 years old at the time, and she says to me, "Dad, can we go for a carriage ride?" And I look at my watch, and I see that we're going to take him to the theater to see The Lion King, and I see that we're running out of time, so we really kind of get, because we want to have dinner, we've got to get back to the hotel. So I say, "Not today, honey." And this gigantic construction worker who's out there in a ripped T-shirt and a hard hat leans down and looks at her and says, "Your first time in New York, honey?" And my daughter looks up at him and goes, "Yeah." So he takes $20 out of his pocket and he slaps me in the chest with it. And he says, "Take the kid on a carriage ride."
That's
he doesn't say "you cheap SOB," but you know that's what he's thinking, right? He gets, so I kick the $20 and I say, "Thank you very much." I give it back to him. I say, "We're late for something, but thank you. That's very sweet." He leans back down to my daughter and he says to her, "I tried, honey. What can I do?" That would never happen in Washington. It might. I don't know about the Midwest. You know, they're pretty friendly in the Midwest, so maybe it would happen in the Midwest. But you know, that's the charm of New York to me, is that you have all these people. They're glammed together in very tight corners, but they see each other and they reach out to each other, and think we really need to do more of that.
Right. Well, yeah, I agree. But we've halted. There's the, you know, the biggest. I am of an age to realize this. One of the big problems with people getting together in social environments is, you know, the places where they used to dance halls and get togethers, and yeah, there was a little bit of drinking.
Right.
They've clamped down on that so much. Mm-hmm. And nobody's thought about that. I mean, what do you do? What do kids want to do? You know, get together in those manners. You know, now it becomes to excess. They spend a lot of money going on one quick trip a year, or you know, and that's it. They're spending all the rest of their times on that phone. They're not really interacting anymore. I don't know if we give them as many outlets, and we close those opportunities off too to the older people. We start to clamp down. They start to bring it back. That's not much fun anymore. You know, even that energy becomes, you know, in society. And I know that if I go out drinking, let's say I want to go to a bar, I better be prepared to pay for the taxi both there and back, right? And that's a cost. And you think, you know, your average person can't afford to take a taxi, you know, so he just instead doesn't go out, especially kids. I mean, until you're 30, 40 years old, you're not going to have that kind of dough. You're just not.
Well, you know, I think that
and to stay at a hotel.
Yeah. Well, I don't think we build relationships anymore too because of some of those sorts of things. For example, you know, I have a father-in-law who literally started in the mailroom of his company, and it was the biggest utility in Philadelphia, started in the mailroom. Put himself through night school, got a degree in electrical engineering from one of the top engineering schools in the country, Drexel, and became vice president of the whole company. We don't see that anymore either. How many people do you know that has one job their whole life?
Mm-hmm. Right. No you know? Way.
I mean, yeah. You know, most of these young people have 10 jobs before they're 30.
Jeez.
And it's just crazy. We don't build, everything's disposable all of a sudden. Right. We don't build those relationships anymore. And I think we suffer
Well, great. A novelty would be built to last your lifetime. I mean, that would be like rare. I could imagine a store came up and said, guaranteed for life only products.
Yeah.
You know, I'd probably shop there.
Well, you're talking to a guy whose iPhone is dying by the day. You know, like it does all sorts of weird stuff now. And I read on the internet that they make them obsolete.
Right. Like the bucket handles, if you want to carry rocks, but they eventually go with their little plastic. If they put a little thing on them, it would cost them maybe a tenth of a cent to put this little steel thing around the holes of the bucket handles, and it would last. But no.
Yeah. Yeah.
Almost everything seems to be built that way. When you get into it, you take it apart. It's like the gasket, the O-ring, cost just millions. But man, why is it that thing costs go away? And all the steel around it, it doesn't matter.
Well, you know, my grandfather was a cabinet maker. It came from many generations of cabinet makers, and his work was really art. It's just amazing, the cabinets and stuff that I have in my house from him. But I asked somebody one day who was a woodworker. He only used hand tools and stuff, and I said, why don't people do this kind of work anymore? Because he was just amazed at how beautiful it was. And he said, well, because he was an apprentice probably as a young boy, and in the time it took him to learn to do this, you can learn to be a brain surgeon now.
Right.
There aren't people that put 60 years into a career of doing something as simple as making cabinets or furniture. Mm-hmm. We're all about. I see every day more and more stuff about online universities, and I think, how long is it going to be before nobody goes to a university anymore?
Here's a good one.
We all sit down on our computers.
We'll have a computer that creates the best art, and we won't even have to be artistic. You know, you'd think that creativity, we need cabinet makers. Well, not really. Well, we would need one to make a really creative new. Well, maybe not even then. I think there's only going to be one job into the future, Senator. There's only going to be one type of job in the future, and all the rest aren't going to be doing anything. You're either going to rule, code, or not do anything. What I mean by code is actually going in and understanding how to fix code that makes these machines operate. Sooner or later, they're going to fix themselves. I can imagine what you and I were to envision the future, maybe a couple hundred years. Could you imagine that a human being would have the sophistication in his brain to code a computer?
Yeah, maybe not. And you know what? Stephen Hawking just passed away, and that was what he left us. He said, artificial intelligence is a danger to humanity in the future.
Right.
That's what's going to be the great danger. Mm. And I certainly can see it, you know.
Right.
And the guy said, and there'll be one guy, he'll be a gazillionaire, right? Because he'll control all the machines, right? Everything work for him, you know.
Right. Well, you know, everybody wants the world to believe that it's going to get better. Let's say if we look out 500 years or 1,000 years, you know, I hear there's many people that want to believe in, you know, a new system that's going to take place, or divine intervention, or an alien group is going to save us, or we're all going to wake up and experience a kundalini, or, you know, you name it, you know, Nisera, or a million different understandings of what could be possible into the future with, you know, the fact that good's going to trump evil, or we're all going to get this right and we're going to live in paradise or utopia. Well, you know, I see it a little differently.
Yeah.
I see extremes getting more extreme.
Yeah.
And good becoming more good. It's almost like you're going to see more, like, imagine a bubble keeping to expanding. It's just going to take in more bad. It's going to take in more good. The spectrum, the pendulum that goes right and left is going to go further left and further right. So you're going to have gazillionaires, and you're going to have, you know, the total freedom again, while some group of humans colonize some planet somewhere. So you'll have, you know, a lot of beginnings like we had here, and a lot of ends just going to expand into the universe. That's how I see the future. But in that universe, there's going to be even greater evil things that you and I think now, I mean, this is nothing. Wait till a guy picks his finger and he puts it to a, you know, and he blows up a galaxy per se, right? I mean, who knows what's to come? But that would be truly evil. Can you imagine? But we're going to experience those things as we experience even more love and joy to combat those understandings. So it's going to be a hoot. I don't ever believe that we're, you know, you're going to have some dynamic shift to the good old, the good new age. You know, the time where we were all thinking this is paradise. I just don't see that. I see paradise now and into the future because you have so many different scenarios going on, choices, infinite possibilities. That's how I see the future. Infinite possibilities, because I don't have a dogmatic point of view. The robots are going to take us over or they're going to control us. No, I see us actually going out into space, colonizing different planets, and having, you know, a growth from those new environments, just like we had when we were starting here. You know, we grew on those planets. You know, we became something else over time. That's how I'd like to see the future.
Well, I think that's one of the reasons, and I'm not being tongue-in-cheek here, but this is one of the reasons that I've always supported the space program, because I think that our ultimate salvation as mankind lies somewhere else in the universe. All right. I think that, well, we will get to a point where we've done so much damage to this planet of ours. Right. But I hope that we're wising up to that. And just to bring the conversation full circle for a little while, let me tell you that at this global meeting where we were talking about the world and problems and solutions and what people are doing in the world, there were a few common themes. One of them was global climate change. You know, I think everybody there said global climate change is not something that we can deal with ourselves. No single nation, right, can deal with it. We need to come together over this.
It's like pollution.
And so, you know, it's just, you know, it was good to see people coming together over common problems. And not just, let me tell you, this was the first thing that I'd ever been to in my life where people were actually people that ran major corporations. I had dinner the first night, and I sat next to a guy that won the Nobel Prize.
Wow.
You know, these were important people that were doing things that were changing the world, and they came to listen. Hmm. You know, I'm in politics, so what we do is we wait to talk. You know? We do. I don't give a damn what you have to say. I'm here to tell you what I have to say.
I love it.
Yeah. And this was like the first thing that I'd been to and that I can remember where they were, you know, listening. And one of the things that made this so unusual for me was that there was this mix of really important sessions about business and an emerging world, and also things that were very humanizing. For example, they did things like emerging trade barriers was one thing that, you know, one seminar, and modeling sustainable migration was another one. But there was also inspiring our future and how to reach happiness. Important things like global risk and closing the gender gap and creating sustainable energy policies but also things like blue peace and the American dream and things like one seminar was simply attending school is not getting an education.
Wow.
And, you know, embracing artificial intelligence and some of the impact investing, but also the power of love. was one, and reflect on the story of your life, and art and theater for expressing hope and world economic, you know, outlook, but also and sessions on democracy, but also things about you know, how to be happy.
Wow.
And how to, you know, that happiness isn't something, and that was one that I attended, by the way, how to be happy. And one of the things they said that was really interesting to me is that happiness is not something that occurs to you. And I think that's kind of the way we feel about it. You know, like, I'm going to win the lottery,
right,
and I'm gonna be happy. Or I'm going to get a new car, and I'm going to be happy. Mm. Or I'm going to marry the right person, I'm going to be happy. They said, no, it's actually something that you pursue and that you make happen in your life just the way you do other things. And they provided strategies for
that. I almost believe it's how you perceive things to be, mm-hmm, more than the things that you almost pursue. Though you got to pursue the things that you love, at least inside, give you, you know, a feeling of peace and joy on some level. But yeah.
Well, you know, it's funny that you say that, because what kept coming back to me over and over again is a line from a Sheryl Crow song, which is, it's not having what you want, it's wanting what you have.
Right. You know,
and I just think that's so profound. You know, every good thing I've ever heard in life comes from some rock and roll song somewhere. But you know, I just kept on thinking about that. Yeah, it's really not about getting what I want. It's about wanting what I get and figuring out a way to make what I've got work.
Be grateful for what you got by looking at it maybe in a sense that the rewards, even though you went through so much pain, you see, whatever reward you can think in your brain is more value than all the rest of it, and you think of it positively. Right. In fact, you'd be surprised what the brain could do. I know you're not. There are people out there that are amazing, but you can condition the mind even by saying positive thoughts in your head, even when you're doing something you hate. You don't say, I hate it. Mm-hmm. Say, gosh, I love this. Try it out. I mean, it's crazy. You do something you hate and just say, gosh, you know, I love this. Ooh. I love this.
Yeah.
Just keep, while you're doing it, you know, and it might take a while, but I promise. I mean, I shouldn't say that. I can't do that. Sorry, I can't go that far. It's like being a broker and saying, I guarantee it. I don't promise, but I believe that it will actually impact the way you think. Sooner or later, you will enjoy. You won't know why, but you've reaffirmed it in your brain somehow. And that incrementally can change you. It can change you to be a better human being if you want to be, just based on those positive affirmations of what it makes you feel, and it should be on a good side. You know, it doesn't make, as soon as you say you hate it, you're going to hate it. Hormones are going to be released. There's going to be stress and anxiety. Your DNA is going to warp. No, I'm joking.
Right.
Kid's going to grow up deformed. Oh, my goodness.
Well, you know, I mean, this is one of the reasons, not to get too far away from what you're talking about, this is one of the reasons that always bugs me when I look at education, for example, and I see that the first thing they cut out is art and music because they think it's not important, right? Mm. No matter how much you know about art or music, it's really not going to help you get a job, and unless, of course, you want to be a musician or an artist. But it's education for your soul, for God's sakes. It really is, in my opinion, it's the most important thing to teach people, because in that way it teaches them to be happy. Which right. one and look at how universal it is. Sure. Which one of us, when have you ever heard anybody say, oh, I hate music? Oh my God, I just hate music. Don't you? Right. You know, it's really, those are really the things that connect, and they connect us, you know.
They're treasured. They're our most treasured things on many levels.
Yes, yes, right. And that's that really bothers me, too, is that nobody ever sits around and says, let's talk about the ancient Greeks and how, you know, what their first grocery stores look like. No, we talk about their art. We talk about their culture. We talk, right?
Right.
You know,
right.
Nobody, you
their
know.
Art and their music almost defines the culture.
Well, not really, but I mean, such a huge part.
In a lot of ways, yeah. You know, and you know, and you need to teach children. You need to teach them about the great thinkers that have come.
They're the smartest. I know that I shouldn't say it, but I could imagine that the art people who write prose and poetry and create works of art that are just genius, they're probably some of the smartest people of IQ, if we base them on their IQ, that exist, I'd imagine.
Right. And well, and you think about some of them, you know, they knew everything there was to know in their time. People like the Renaissance, people like Michelangelo and Leonardo da Vinci. Mm-hmm. I mean, they knew engineering. They knew they knew art. They knew science. They knew music. They knew everything. Right. You know, in fact, it's funny. One of my mentors, I guess, in life was Thomas Jefferson, and you know, I devour everything I can find out about him, and you know, he was a man. In addition, a lot of people don't know he played the violin. Mm. He was a great architect. Mm. He designed Monticello and other great architectural things. He was an artist. He was probably the greatest writer of his time. You know, I mean, so that's what we need to be. We need to be more well-rounded, right? And the way we get that is to not just learn how to put the widget together.
Do we have to learn how to feel? Art gives us the ability to feel.
Yes.
And I don't even think a person can awaken, you know, in respect to the love quality or that they can express until they experience art on some level. I think it's an imperative thing for the growth of the human, you know, soul in a uniquely. It saddens me to see that these things are becoming less important and we're eradicating them. It saddens me that we pay teachers so little. It saddens me that they aren't as revered as doctors are.
Yes. We ought to pay lawyers less and teachers more.
You got to get lawyers out of politics.
Yes.
You should have somebody writing a law that bans all lawyers from politics. Then the citizens of America might truly believe in hope.
And think about how many jobs would open up in Washington, D.C. for my kids. The population would drop by about a third if we got all the lawyers in politics. No. But look, before we leave, I want to read something that I put out there when we started this thing about the American dream. And this was about dreamers when they were talking about deporting dreamers. Everybody knows that dreamers are kids that were brought to the United States as children by their parents. And there's been talk about deporting them because they you know, came into the country undocumented. And I just think it's crazy. And I just want to read this. This is what I wrote. America was built by dreamers. We often say that it was built by hardworking men and women, and that's true. But each and every one of them had a dream of a better life, a dream of freedom, independence, and most of all, a dream of a better future for their children. It was the dream of those who came that built America and made it great. Millions from all over the world with dreams who worked hard and made those dreams come true. And the children they brought with them are an extension of their dreams and are as much a part of the fabric of America as the dreams themselves. In fact, America itself is a dream. Inspired by a handful of liberal thinkers in the early 18th century, men like Locke, Rousseau, Hobbes, and Smith, our forefathers brought forth a society which valued and rewarded the individual and replaced heretical monarchy with self-rule. It was a brave, bold, and audacious dream which led to the creation of a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to proposition that all were created equal, that each of us could dare to dream our dreams and work to realize them, the dream they dreamed has sustained us for more than 200 years and has resulted in building the greatest democracy the world has ever known, where people unite not behind a single dream, but behind a vision of building a society where all dreams are possible. We have dreamed selfless dreams like building the largest middle class the world has ever known, and bold dreams like landing on a man on the moon. Now there are those among us who think we need to build a wall around our dreams to protect them, but they're wrong. Walls kill dreams. Many are afraid of losing the dream that is America or having it stolen, but you can't steal a dream. Dreamers are fragile. If you are told dreams are fragile, if you try to hold them, you will crush them. There is always a risk, but that's what dreams are made of. Never what is, but rather what can be. As the poet said, our reach must exceed our grasp, or what's a heaven for? Dreams always involve taking a chance on tomorrow in hopes of making it better than today. As soon as we stop reaching for what is better in order to protect what we have, the dream will die. We must keep the dreamers because we must keep the dream, and they have always been the ones who have dreamt it. America is one great dream made of millions of smaller dreams. If we lose the dreamers, we start to lose the dream itself. And once we lose the dream that is America, we have lost all that really matters. And I want to leave you with that thought tonight, folks. And thanks so much, Doug. For
you wrote that?
Yes.
You're kidding.
No.
Wow. Power. I just need you to know. Very beautiful.
Thank you.
Very, really moving. You should be a speechwriter.
I am. I write my own speech. The problem is only you and Deborah and my wife are the people that listen. But we're going to get more people out there. We know we're growing every week. And this goes out to one of the great thinkers from California, my friend Doug. Here's a song from the Police. One World Is Enough. Thanks, folks. We'll see you next week.
One world is enough for all of us. Give the people their right to vote.